We're also going to look into some economic and educational issues on this edition of our weekly news magazine. Hi there, I'm Jack Hopke. Very glad to have you along. There is a boom in natural gas production here in the U.S., a boom so big the market can't absorb it all. Prices, in turn, have been driven to 10-year lows, and that threatens the viability of some energy producers and makes them a little tense. NPR's John Idstey spoke with Tulane's Peter Ricciuti to see if it's possible the country could run out of room to store the gas.
The unusually warm weather this winter is one reason for the natural gas glut. It reduced the need for people to burn gas heating their homes. But a bigger reason is the explosion of gas production made possible by new methods of coaxing gas out of shale rock formations.
The natural gas supply in the United States is an incredible glut, like we have never seen before.
That's Peter Ricciuti, a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans and an expert on oil and gas production. Ricciuti says the normal supply and demand laws of economics aren't working as they used to in the industry.
Historically, this has always been kind of a self-governing mechanism. When natural gas prices got too low, you'd start to see the industry lay down rigs until prices went back up again, and it was very effective. It was sometimes jokingly referred to as the redneck OPEC.
But that's not happening this time. Ricciuti says there are a couple of reasons the industry isn't responding as usual to price pressures. One is that during the shale gas explosion of the past few years, production companies spent big bucks leasing mineral rights in vast shale gas areas from Pennsylvania to Texas. Joe Averett lives in the middle of one of them, the Haynesville Shale in northern Louisiana. The oil and gas industry veteran says drilling continues there because many of the 3-year leases will expire soon if the producers don't drill.
They're still drilling wells just to hold a lease. And for them having to do that, that's continued the excess production.
Averett says it's not unusual for gas production to outstrip demand at this time of the year as stocks begin to be built for next winter.
But today, it's dramatically more excess production than the consumption.
And that's got him worried.
I think there's a reasonable chance that we will fill up the storage this year.
Averett knows a lot about storage. He's retired now, but his company, Crystal Gas Storage, built some of the huge salt dome caverns for natural gas in Texas and Louisiana. Peter Ricciuti cites one more reason that production continues despite low natural gas prices.
About a third of all natural gas wells have a certain amount of what we call natural gas liquids. That could be propane, butane, things like that. And that's very valuable.
So valuable that it would make economic sense for producers to keep pumping even if the natural gas price goes to zero. Fred Callen, who's a small independent producer based in Mississippi, says the same logic holds for some of his crude oil wells in the Permian Basin in Texas.
Our projects out in the Permian Basin, are, of course, are driven by the crude oil prices, and to the extent that they have associated gas, then that is sold, and so there is new natural gas coming to the market in many of the plays that are driven by crude oil today.
Peter Ricciuti says obviously there's great promise to go along with the problems associated with America's newly found vast amounts of cheap natural gas.
In long term, you've got all these positives. It's clean burning, it's domestically produced, it's abundant, it has all these great properties that seems like a godsend. But yet, for at least in the short term, we're in real trouble down here.
Ricciuti believes ultimately the supply-demand equation will reach balance. After all, every new electrical generation plant on the drawing boards in the U.S. burns natural gas. In addition, trucking firms are looking at a crash program to build natural gas refueling stations along the interstate highway system to refuel new long-haul trucks that burn natural gas. In the meantime, though, the overabundance of natural gas is a threat to many producers. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
John Idstey is a correspondent and host for NPR. He's a regular guest host for shows like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Talk of the Nation. All Things New Orleans for the 19th of April. Welcome again. I'm Jack Hopke. And this is WWNO with your weekly news magazine. Ever since an old Walgreens was transformed into an Episcopal church in the Lower Ninth Ward, a small community has developed around that location. Many organizations are now using the site as a place to tutor children academically and musically. We'll speak this evening with Reverend Lonel Wright, the leader of All Souls Episcopal Church. It's this week's Notes from New Orleans.
My friend Lonel Wright has had several successful careers. He worked in California for Kaiser Permanente as a healthcare professional, returning to his home state of Louisiana as the owner of 5 McDonald's restaurants in New Orleans. After a few intense years running those restaurants, he decided to retire. It was time, he said, to go fishing, play golf, and spend some time with some grandbabies.
And then one day, my parish priest called me and said, Lonel, I want to go to lunch with you. And during the course of lunch, he said to me, I'm not sure of many things, but there's one thing that I'm absolutely certain of, and that is that you have been called to the ordained priesthood. And I almost dropped my teeth, and I said, well, Father, I'm glad God is talking to you, because he ain't telling me that.
So long story short, the life of this, at the time, slightly worn-out businessman who loved classical music and a good book now and then took an unexpected turn.
All this time, I'm saying no. But then this thing started to grow and grow and grow, and I started to feel compelled to go and do something else. You may or may not be religious, and you may or may not believe in any of this, but there was something that was going on within me that I really didn't know about. Finally, I end up well into my 60s. I think I was in my 65th year, and I end up in theological seminary.
Now an ordained Episcopal priest running All Souls Church in a former drugstore on the corner of St. Claude Avenue and Caffin in the Lower Nine, he says he's never been happier, helping children of all ages learn to love reading and music as he does.
I believe for a well-rounded person, you have to get exposed to culture. Culture comes in many forms, literature and in music. We have a library at our facility, and we are encouraging the kids to read and to get books. And, you know, I have been blown away recently by having little kids who have been with us for 2 or 3 years, kids who come from a very toxic family situation, come to me and said, Pastor, I want to get into the library to get a book.
And nothing thrills the now Reverend Lonel Wright more than those few words.
My day is made when that happens, because now we are affecting that child. And when those kids will sit and read a book and say, I want a book, take it home with you. If you want another book, come and get another book. We've got plenty of books and we'll give you books. We want you to read.
And then there's the musical activities he has initiated with the help of UNO and Loyola University faculties and volunteer musicians from across the city.
We teach kids string instruments. We have formed in the Lower Ninth Ward the Youth Orchestra of the Lower Ninth Ward. That youth orchestra is a combination of primarily of 3 institutions, Trinity Church, Wall Street, the University of New Orleans, Loyola University Music Program, and people who are teaching in the public schools to come in and teach our kids string music. So every day between 5 and 6, we have 20 to 25 kids that are getting instructions and playing violin, viola, cello, and string bass. And some of the kids are really taking to it. And so a great deal of the gratification and a great deal of what happens with an old man like myself who works long hours a day is the fact that there are those little graces. When you see a kid that's really enjoying music and that is excelling at that, then, boy, that makes your day and gives you a lot of energy.
Reverend Wright admits that life running a cash-strapped church in Lower Nine is a challenge. But challenge or not, he's in it for the future because he says it's so important.
And you know something? At 72 years old, I am having the time of my life. I have never done anything that is more meaningful. And, you know, I work almost as hard as I did at McDonald's. The only thing that I don't have to do is get up at 4 a.m. when people don't call in to work. But How many people do you know who are 72 years old who get the opportunity to be doing every day of their lives something that they know that they are called to do?
You can find more information about All Souls Episcopal Church projects and programs in Lower Nine at WWNO.org or go to NOLAVIE.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Litwin.
Sharon is the former executive director of the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra and the co-founder of NOLAVIE.com. This is All Things New Orleans. You can hear all of our features whenever you want to at our website, WWNO.org. Just a reminder, Jack Hopke along. And next, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, perhaps there is no more active a personality in all of New Orleans than a musician, or a good musician, at least during festival season. During their busy schedules, Mark Mullins and Craig Klein, two-thirds of the triple trombone attack in funk rock ensemble Bonorama, we're able to swing by our studios to discuss their careers. WWNO's Paul Mawson spoke with the trombonist and began by asking Klein about the band's roots.
Mark and I played with Harry Connick Jr. for many, many years. We spent a lot of time in New York, and somebody told me that Monday nights was salsa meets jazz at the Village Gate, and one of the guys in Harry's band. So I went down and heard this Cuban band. I think it was Manny Ortega, Kim, I'm mispronouncing his last name. And he had five trombones along with his Cuban band. I came back and talked to Mark and said, we should start a band, a New Orleans band that features the trombone. And the next day, Mark had all of these arrangements already written, and we were like, we were moving from there.
You know, over the years, I mean, you know, this is 14 years ago when we put this together, and this is before, you know, nobody knew who Trombone Shorty was or Big Sam, and it was, I mean, you had brass bands, and you had, and when you go outside of New Orleans, you didn't even have that all that much, and so just the trombone by nature, you know, it was, you're going to put a band together around that, are you crazy, you know? So it was almost like we're doing it to maybe try to change the way people think about the trombone with the New Orleans stamp on it, but also just to try to do something fun, you know, because there's so many great trombone players in New Orleans.
And you guys are also just really good at mixing different styles, you know, kind of the New Orleans sound, rock sound, jazz, putting it all together. Do you do that consciously, or how does that happen?
We do it consciously. I think it's a conscious thing. Growing up in New Orleans, of course, the New Orleans sound is just naturally there. When you mix the other sounds in with it, it's a conscious effort. And Mark is the one who consciously brought a lot of the rock stuff in, and it's just blossomed from there, even in the way we're writing the music now.
I think of it as an extension of what's in your music collection. I think it's safe to say a lot of us have a lot of different things in our music collection. But yet sometimes there's this thought that if you're a musician, you really need to kind of just do one thing, or you got to be known as playing one kind of music to be true to your craft. And I have a bit of a problem with that personally, so because I like so much different stuff. I mean, I'm like, well, why can't you, you know? And to us it was like, let's just blur the lines. Nobody likes to classify stuff via genre anyway, you know. It's kind of unpopular in a lot of ways. We do it because we have to do it, but at the end of the day, I think we all like music and good music, and that's what we're striving to do.
I gotta ask this question. Do you ever, you know, when you're playing a gig, you ever walk to a club and you show up with all the trombones, does somebody kind of go, what in the world? What is this? What kind of looks do you get?
Yeah. It starts with the sound guy, I think. Because he's like, oh, my God, it's going to be a long night. And at the end of the night, you know, most of the time, I should say, we're flattered that if they come up to us and say, well, that was so unlike anything I thought it was going to be. And you know, he's just nothing but good things to say. But that happens sometimes. So that's flattering to see that.
You know, what do you strive for when you're performing? Is that what you're looking to do? You know, create a different space, or how does that work? Well,
I don't think it was. I don't think we started out saying let's be different. It just kind of, I mean, we played the trombone, so we I think it was for ourselves actually to try to pull all of these elements together, because in New Orleans you can play with a funk band, you can play with a brass band, you can play with a rock band, you can play with a Dixieland band, a trad band, and I think we kind of we try to pull all of these things together so we don't have to play with all of these different bands. We can make it all in one.
Let's talk about writing. The EP, which is the latest, is called Hard Times, and there's a song in there called Lost My House. Can you talk about, you know, the influences and what goes into your writing, and tell us how it worked in that particular song?
That song is co-written by myself and Dave Malone from The Radiators. And Dave's a really great songwriter. He's got many years of writing a lot of songs, and he came up with this, the hook and like the hook of the song, and gave it to me, and then I took it from there and pretty much ruined it from his perspective.
He's not coming after you.
He already did. But it's all about personal experiences, you know, for me and both of us. You know, we kind of pull from a lot of that. This song is about, it was written after the flood, you know. It's about losing, we both lost our houses in the flood, but we still had the things that matter the most, friends and, you know, family and all of the things that just are more important than just the structure of a house.
For you, Mark, where does it come from? Where do you draw inspiration?
A lot of different places. It could be based on something like a riff. I like to come up with ideas when I'm driving. I'll actually
the car. That's
the
place.
I'm the guy when we're driving ourselves.
That's the muse. The car. All right.
I tell you, the white dotted line. Everything's the same tempo. I don't know why. You get these ideas that just kind of come to you when you're doing 500 miles a day and you're behind the wheel and it's just you can't get out of that chair and you're puts you in a space and you get to come up with ideas and things and thoughts that you wouldn't normally come up with at your house in the morning in front of a piano necessarily, and vice versa. So lots of different ways. I like to be in lots of different environments to write, but it starts with the germ of an idea usually, and to me it's about keeping open the possibilities of where that germ can develop and not limiting yourself or making yourself go down a certain avenue just because you're sort of supposed to from any songwriter rules. I like to explore it all and see where it goes.
So what's next?
Well, it's festival season. So
it'll be a jazz fest, right?
It'll be a jazz fest. We'll be there on the second Friday on the Sprints, the Gentilly stage, excuse me. Can't keep up with all of this. What do you call it? The one over there.
That
big one. On there.
Just give people a sense of what it's like to play at those, you know, at French Quarter Fest and Jazz Fest in front of those crowds.
Oh, Jazz Fest. I remember the first time we played Jazz Fest with our band. We played it for years with other people's bands, and the first time we did it with Bonorama, it was a nice festival moment as nobody knew anything about the band, but we started playing, I don't know, Funky Miracle by the Meters maybe, and just these people just started running towards the stage like from as far as you could see, and like just moments like that being out at the fairgrounds for both sides of the stage, for the musicians to experience that feeling of being on this high, huge stage playing music for a lot of people that are there for other bands, not necessarily for you, and yet you're reaching these folks. And then for them, because they know, you know, they're seeing something for the first time they may not have seen before. So just it's just a wonderful two-way street out there at French Quarter Fest and Jazz Fest. French Quarter Fest, you see these people from all over the world, it seems like, from Europe and Australia, and just for some reason it seems like it's just got a little bit more of an international turnout, and that's wonderful to see.
How about you, Craig?
It's, you know, looking out and seeing thousands of people listening and watching what you do is pretty humbling. It's it feels good, and when the band's clicking and it's kicking and the energy's there. It's a connection, and it just feels. It's hard to explain that feeling, but it's something magical that you just kind of starts in your toes and just goes all the way up to the crown of your head.
Craig Klein and Mark Mullins from Bonorama, gentlemen, thanks for coming out and continue making great music.
Thank you so much.
For a list of upcoming performances or to find out more about the band, visit BonoramaMusic.com. This is All Things New Orleans, and even though the presidential primary season has wound down, the nasty political ads and robocalls have taken and continue to take their toll. Many people are, to paraphrase former VP Al Gore, getting snippy about their political differences. If we're going to make it till Election Day, commentator Gwen Tompkins thinks, we'd better all learn how to disagree without being disagreeable.
I had the most invigorating political discussion the other day with a man who didn't believe a word I said. I didn't believe anything he said either, but that made the conversation all the more fun. We'd met years ago when I was a newspaper reporter and needed somebody to teach me fast about Louisiana politics. He was a political consultant, a Cambridge-educated man, no less. And when others recommended him to me, they consistently used the word brilliant. We had lunch the other day at one of the best restaurants in New Orleans. And somewhere between my crab meat beignets and his breast of roasted chicken, he announced that Dwight D. Eisenhower was a better president than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that if Nelson Rockefeller had won the White House in 1960, Rockefeller would have made more inroads on civil rights than John Kennedy. Now, the technical term, I believe, for these kinds of comparisons is pish-tosh. It's impossible to say who was a better chief executive when each president faced a different world and a wholly different political landscape. Nor is it fair to suppose what someone might have done as president. For example, if James Brown had been president, he might have gotten rid of Hail to the Chief and instead used one of his own songs, Papa Don't Take No Mess. And yet between a couple of Americans within easy reach of hot buns, soft butter, iced tea, and lemonade, all in politics is fair. My lunch companion and I did agree on some matters. For instance, the French fries here are excellent. But what made our lunch memorable was how deeply we disagreed and how congenially. I remember we laughed a lot, and the best part was that each of us had a chance to finish a sentence. By the time my lunch companion and I were done, the busboys were tidying the tables, and all the other diners had gone. We vowed to come back soon, and I, for one, am looking forward to it. Let's hope there are similar conversations running at lunch tables nationwide. Talking politics with someone who agrees with everything you say is about as satisfying as kissing a mirror. At the very least, people who have different political ideas remind you of why you believe what you do. So here are the ground rules. Make sure there's good food on the table, think about what the other person has to say, and try like hell to get a word in edgewise.
Gwen Tompkins is a contributor to NPR programming who lives in the New Orleans area. She can be heard regularly here on WWNO New Orleans, KTLN Thibodaux Houma, and WWNO.org, celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. Time to wrap this week's edition of All Things New Orleans and bring you fresh air. A reminder that all our features are archived for anytime access at our new look, new content, pneumatic website, WWNO.org. GM Paul Mawson, producer-editor Thomas Walsh, and I are your production team for ATNO each week, and we thank you for listening. I'm Jack Hopke. Going to see you next Thursday? You betcha.